Comments made on the Serotalk Podcast Network are those of the individuals and do not represent Serotalk Corporation, its staff, management, board of directors, or third-party resellers.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another SPN special. I'm Jamie Pauls. Last December, Buddy Brennan went to New York to help our friends over at HIMSS dedicate the very first UN Accessibility Center. Along with the interviews he got from the United Nations, he also went to the Seeing Eye in Morristown, New Jersey. We have quite a bit of audio from that event, but we're going to start with an interview he did with the president of the Seeing Eye, Mr. Jim Kutch. At the time of this interview, Mr. Kutch was the only president of a U.S. guide dog school who was also a guide dog user himself. Buddy and Jim cover a lot of ground in the next half hour, so sit back and relax because I think you're going to enjoy everything they have to say. I'll talk to you after they're done.
I'm joined today, well, joined in his living room by Jim Kutch, who is the president of the Seeing Eye. Hi, Jim.
Hello, buddy.
Fancy seeing you in your living room.
Yes. It's amazing the way that works.
So, Jim is the president and CEO of the Seeing Eye, and you've been the president for...
About 8 years, since August of 2006.
And as far as I'm aware, you have the unique distinction of being the only person, at least in this country, who is the CEO of a guide dog school and also a guide dog user.
At the moment, that is true, but there have been blind presidents of other guide dog schools over history.
Yes, certainly.
Yes.
I think Fidelco's most recent one, not the guy there now, but the guy before that,
right,
was, and I'm sure there were others, but Seeing Eye, you were Seeing Eye's first.
Correct.
In its history, and the Seeing Eye is not the first guide dog school in the world, but certainly the oldest continuously running school in the world.
We were founded in January of 1929, so January 29 of 2014 marks our 85th anniversary.
That's a long...
It's a lot of dogs.
And a lot of dogs, yes. Not all shepherds. They started out with shepherds, but have trained all sorts of breeds.
Mostly shepherds in the early days, a few others along the way. Today, we do four breeds. We do German shepherds, still a lot of them. It's our heritage. We do golden retrievers, Labrador retrievers, and then we began a program to crossbreed the Labrador retriever to the golden retriever, and those crosses today make up a substantial percentage of our canine population.
So, as a Seeing Eye dog user yourself, I'm sure that lends a unique perspective to the job that perhaps people who came before you did not have.
Well, the Seeing Eye has a long and rich history. I mean, clearly we had many individuals who were blind that were involved in the Seeing Eye along the way. Morris Frank, one of our co-founders, has to be top of the list of people to mention. What Morris did was absolutely amazing, and even more so when you consider the environment, the political, cultural environment in which he did it. No ADA, none of the awareness and things for today. He was truly, truly groundbreaking in his day in the 1920s. And then over the years, we've had others such as Bob Wittstock, Dave Liu, and many others, or I could add to the list of individuals who have worked there. I am the first person, as you said, to serve in the role of president of the organization. But again, I follow in the footsteps of lots of other blind folks who have done a lot for the Seeing Eye.
Yeah, a lot of great names in the history. And the Seeing Eye does have a history, a very colorful history, as you've said, and I've been one that follows that and am really interested in that. Being the oldest continuously running guide dog school in the world, I'm sure has, with all the history, comes a lot of tradition and also a lot of inertia. So what do you see as the challenge, not only the advantages, but also the challenges of that history and sort of all the inertia, 85 years of history?
Well, it's an interesting mix between looking at that rich history, that rich legacy, and hanging on to all the good things over all those years, yet at the same time, be able to evolve and change as is necessary in any organization to meet the demands, you know, the demands of today. We certainly, going back to Morris Frank era, we certainly don't have to worry too much about horse-drawn carriages and the like these days. We do have to worry about hybrid cars, which Morris never had to contend with. So we have to preserve the best of the past while putting in everything we need to do to evolve for the future. It's sort of a continuous improvement process that all organizations face. And, you know, it's very tempting times to say, but we've always done it that way. And saying, but we've always done it that way is okay as long as it still makes sense to do it that way today. But every time we have to look at it and say, yes, we've always done it that way, but is that way still the way, the best way for the situations of today?
And of course, on the other hand, I guess it's important to also consider that history and not sort of throw it out in the name of progress.
Oh, absolutely not. The history has to be maintained because, again, we, in effect, set the state of the art over all those years. The challenge is just not becoming complacent, not saying, well, you know, that's good enough. We don't have to change. But huge, huge successes over the years. Traffic training, we're known for our traffic training for dogs and for students. We're involved in a lot of advocacy work, follow-up services for our graduates if they're having trouble in the field. Known for our ownership policy, when an individual graduates from the CNI, they completely and totally own the dog that they graduate with. And those are all very, very important things that go way back in our history and certainly are not things that we would consider changing or modernizing.
Let's talk about the ownership policy and the fee that CNI charges for its dogs, you know, because most of the schools, at least in the U.S., and I think really a lot of them, maybe not all of them, but a lot worldwide, provide their dogs to their students free of cost to the student. What's the philosophy then behind why CNI does not?
In the 1930s, the CNI established a tuition, and that tuition, when established, was $150 for the first dog, $50 for any successor dog, and that fee is reduced, both of those fees, are reduced to $1 if the individual is a veteran of U.S. or Canadian military service. And so at the time, the philosophy was that an individual should have a stake in their own rehabilitation, in their own moving forward with life in spite of blindness. And at the time, the tuition represented a fairly significant percentage of the true cost of training and producing a seeing eye dog. We have elected over the years not to increase the tuition because for many, many years, we were the only game in town. As you point out, other schools came on the scene after some years and they started not charging anything. So we didn't want our tuition to increase and make a radical difference between seeing eye tuition being a high number and other schools tuition being free. So we preserved it at $150, but still adhere to the philosophy that it is important for an applicant or student coming to our program to have a stake in the acquisition of and the training with their seeing eye dog. And we ask that the individuals not do fundraisers. We ask the individual actually come up with this money themselves, and it's their payment for the tuition of going to the program.
In other words, somebody can't pay it for a student.
I mean, of course, we would never know if somebody did that, but philosophically, that's our request,
right?
Is yes, you don't ask somebody else to pay this fee for you. But on the other hand, the true cost today of producing a dog, as I said early, $150 was a big chunk of it. It was on the order of a third to maybe even 40-45% of the true cost. Today, the true cost is somewhere in excess of $60,000. And so the $150 is an extremely small percentage of that $60,000. So there is a lot that's paid, using your words, by someone else. And that's through all of our fundraising programs. The fundraising is an extremely important part of the Seeing Eye, as is true in all guide dog programs around the world, because it's very expensive to do what we all do in the guide dog schools. You don't want a low quality guide dog. It's pretty important for the dog to get it right. You know, you look at some of the statistical measures of quality that are used in other businesses, even five nines, you know, 99.999% quality is not very good for a guide dog when you consider that yours, mine, and all users of guide dogs, our safety and in a sense, in a real sense, our lives are held in the paws of our dogs.
Right. So that 0.0005% is pretty important. And then you mentioned the ownership policy. Ever since the Seeing Eye began, ownership was transferred to the blind person upon completion of training. And that's different from a lot of how a lot of schools handle that. A lot of them either own the dog or they say that the blind person owns the dog with the following conditions. If you want to talk about that.
Sure. I can't speak for other schools, but I can certainly talk about our philosophy at the Seeing Eye. And it really dates back again to Maurice Frank's era. At that time, the reality is blind people held a very low position in society, certainly here in the United States and probably in most of the rest of the parts of the world as well. And at that time, blind people weren't owners of things. They couldn't hold title to a deed to a house or other things. In going back to an early philosophy of increasing independence and dignity of people who are blind, my predecessors felt it was extremely important for the blind person to own their dog. And this is really meaningful because it was in an environment when blind people couldn't own much of anything else. So this was really the standout exception that you could own something, and it was your own dog. Over the years, that's far less important, although I will say that there are still some countries in the world today where people who are blind are not allowed to open bank accounts, and it's pretty deplorable. But that aside, today, the importance is more around any possible injury or something that may happen to your dog. Clearly, the dignity part still holds, the dignity of knowing it's your dog and you own it and you are responsible for the care and feeding of your dog and veterinary care and so on. But in the unlikely event that your dog is injured by somebody else and you wish to initiate some sort of action, legal action to get damages or get vet bills paid and so on, that process becomes very cumbersome, if not impossible, when the dog is owned by a third party, when it isn't your dog. So today, in a very practical sense, ownership is important, we believe, because it allows the blind person to do whatever they need to do with respect to their dog.
But I want to stress here that ownership does not mean that the Seeing Eye does not stand behind their dogs.
Correct. Absolutely true. I mean, we are still every bit as available as we ever were to support all of our teams. Follow-up services, sometimes called aftercare services, is an extremely important component of our program. We are available first by phone. We can help with a lot of issues and problems by phone. Our graduates call our training department and they talk to training managers. And oftentimes, just some discussions over the phone is enough to fix an issue or a problem. But failing that, we have instructors, in fact, all of our instructors and our managers are available to travel throughout both the U.S. and Canada to visit with our graduates and help remediate a problem that may occur afterward. One of the differences between the Seeing Eye and some of the other schools is we don't require any mandatory follow-up. There are some schools that do an annual checkup or a periodic checkup. We're available if a graduate wants help, but that help is never forced and a checkup is never forced. We're equally happy with the individual who graduates from our program and we don't hear from them again until they're ready to retire that dog and to come and train with the next dog. We're equally happy, as happy with them as we are with the individual who has a problem and calls us and wants some help, and we'll go either help them by phone or help them in person as necessary.
I think that goes back to your previous point about respect for your blind students and sort of putting our own destiny in our own hands. If we want or need the help, then it's on us to ask for it.
I think that's a good way of saying it. Our philosophy is one of empowering blind people to have increased mobility through the use of a seeing eye dog. And it's not a dependent relationship on the seeing eye. It's an empowering relationship where we're here certainly to support our graduates, but we're delighted as they just go out and do whatever they're going to do in life, maybe done a little better, a little easier, because they have their furry seeing eye friend, you know, at their side. I can certainly speak for myself. I trained with my first dog in 1970 when I was a freshman in college, and Vegas is now dog number 8 for me. And my dogs made a tremendous difference in my life over all those years. I mean, my dogs were with me all through college and graduate school. Later, I was a professor. Later, I was a researcher and then middle manager, and still later, executive and senior executive in the telecommunications industry. Had 4 kids, you know, did all the typical vacation things and business trips and everything else. And all of that, could I have done it without a dog? Sure. I'm not going to say I wouldn't have been able to do any of that without my dog. But I absolutely can tell you that every one of those things was so much easier, in my opinion, because I had one of my 8 dogs at my side doing all those things of life.
Yeah, I would say the same. I've really enjoyed working a dog for the past 16 years, because that was a year between. 16 years I've worked a dog, and I'd agree with all of that. I'm not one personally who adheres to the dog as social icebreaker theory, mostly because I just want people to leave me alone so I can get where I'm going. And also, they kind of tend to focus on the dog, and you can't get them onto anything else. At least I can't. But, I mean, I just really enjoy working a dog, and there are definite advantages to it. We've talked about that on a previous podcast. There was a discussion about that a long time ago. We've had, oh, hello, clock.
Now everyone will know what time it is.
That's right.
One of my other hobbies, I'm a clock collector. Sorry about that. At least there's only one running in this room.
There we go. That's a great clock. Besides being the administrator of a multi-million dollar program, Jim collects clocks and plays with radios and computer things and all kinds of things. So, you've been at this since, you said, 2006.
Six.
And for you, I've asked all the other guys this question. So for you, what's the most rewarding aspect of your job?
You may have heard this before, and I didn't hear all of your other interviews, but for me, the biggest difference is the difference that we make in individuals' lives. For 3 years, I was a university professor of computer science at West Virginia University. And I always was excited about the difference that 4 years makes in a young person's life. Person comes in as a college freshman and 4 years later graduates as a senior and is ready to go tackle life and do great things. And I see the same sort of difference in a greatly accelerated scale. It took us 4 years to get people out of college. At the Seeing Eye, we get them out in 4 weeks. And so every year, I used to say we have 12 classes. Now that we've finished some campus renovation, we are from now on going to have 13 classes a year. So I should start learning to say 13. Anyway, we'll have 13 classes a year where individuals come in and in 4 short weeks learn to work with a new dog, either for their first time ever, and I remember my first time ever, as I'm sure we all do, or for the next dog or the next dog, and it's just great to see the difference this makes in individuals' lives. And starting, maybe this sounds selfish, but starting with me. I mean, I've been through the program 8 times, and I certainly know the difference that my dogs have made in my own life.
And really, that we can match a dog and a student and get a working team that's ready to go out there. And true, there are still kinks to work out, and you're still getting to know your dog way after, you know, you leave class. But the fact that, we can do this in 4 weeks is pretty amazing.
It's absolutely amazing. And then when you consider that if the individual's back for a successor dog, we cut a week off of that. So it's really a little bit under 3 weeks, a couple days under 3 weeks to get a successor dog. As you point out, it's not done. I mean, but the person certainly leaves as a safe, and that's the important part, safe and effective team. It takes several months, as you know, and so do others who use guide dogs. It takes several months for a person and the new dog to really fully understand each other and all the subtleties. And it's a two-way street. I mean, we as humans have to understand and get a little bit in the mind of our dogs. But I have to believe that the same is true for our dogs. They have to look at, well, what's this person like? And what do they mean when they do that? And so on. And so it's a bonding experience both ways with the dogs. I mean, the dogs certainly do a lot and support us, but the dogs need a lot of support and encouragement from us, the handlers, at the same time to make them successful.
Okay, so the raging debate, do they know or do they not know that we're blind?
I would come down on the side they absolutely know that we are blind. And I will give a very dramatic example or a specific example from training. When dogs are first trained by their trainer, they're doing something because it makes the trainer happy. So the first thing we want to do with the dogs is we teach them to stay on the sidewalk. A pet dog could care less about staying on the sidewalks. They don't mean anything to a pet dog. A dog's going to go back and forth, follow the scents and so on. They'll be in the grass, they'll be on this. So we first teach them to follow the sidewalks and at the end of the block, stop at the street. Well, again, a pet dog doesn't really care about stopping at the street particularly. This is not anything that's genetically wired into a dog. So the dogs think, well, I don't know why I do this exactly, but my trainer is really happy when I stay on the street and stop at the end of the curb and they make a big fuss and throw a party for me and praise me and so on. And so that kind of continues through training. And one of the things, not the only thing, but one of the things that we look for in training that marks when a dog is ready and finished training is when the dog gets what we call a sense of responsibility. And you'll see this as a dog walks down a sidewalk, a rough sidewalk with uneven pavement. A dog that's not feeling responsible for its person just blows over those rough patches in the sidewalk. But eventually, the dog gets it. It's like, I'm responsible for this person. And they will slow down or show you the cracks in the sidewalk. And it's very personal. Some people who have a high step and don't care about obstacles in this or uneven parts of the sidewalk, the dog will never learn to do that in the same way that they would for somebody who maybe is keeping their feet closer to the ground when they walk and might catch their toes. So they very, very definitely know that they have this sense of responsibility. Whether they actually know it's blindness or whether it's just the sense of responsibility is a difficult question. But I'll tell one other funny story. A lot of times dogs that come back, of course our graduates own their dogs. It's up to our graduates to plan for the dog's retirement. So many of our graduates keep the dog that's retired themselves as a pet when they get a new dog. Some of them give the dog to neighbors or friends. Some people can't do that. And as a safety net, we offer that individuals can turn their dog back to the school. And then we will put it out through our adoption program. So I know the story of this dog that was adopted by a family of sighted individuals. And the first couple of days, the family is in the kitchen, they're eating dinner, and the retired seeing eye dog quietly sneaks into the kitchen, looks at the people at the table, goes over to the trash can, and as quiet as possible without making any noise in the papers or anything, puts its head in the trash can. And suddenly, the family looks at the dog and shouts, "No, get out of the trash can." And the dog looked at them like, "What is this? I've done this forever. And as long as they do it quietly," you could just see the dog thinking, "I've done this quietly forever and I've never been caught. How is it that you knew I was in the trash can?"
Oh, that's funny. I believe it, though. These guys are clever. That's for sure.
Absolutely. But it's part of problem solving. There are a lot of dogs trained for lots of purposes. There are even a lot of service animals, but there is a fundamental difference between a service animal trained as a guide dog and a service animal trained for any other disability. And that is, in the other cases, the disabled person with the service animal can use their sight to see what the dog's doing and direct the dog. In the case of a guide dog, all of the programs are teaching the dog to problem solve. The dog is not relying on the human to give them the direction. An example, if you walk down the street and there's a trash can in the middle of the sidewalk, you as the handler are not going to tell the guide dog whether to take the left-hand side or the right-hand side and go around that trash can. The dog has to look at it, figure it out, and say, well, there's more room on the left, and I'll go to the left. Whereas a dog, in other, even a service animal with other disabilities, has the human can direct the dog with specific commands. We're almost saying to the dog, this isn't a specific command, but we're almost saying to the dog, you figure it out. And so often we as blind people get in situations where even if we're really aware of the environment and really aware of our surroundings, we don't really know what just happens or is happening in front of us. We don't know if there are trucks parked across the sidewalk, if there's construction tape or a sawhorse or something in the way. And we really have to rely on the dog to figure it out. So they do a lot of problem solving.
And it's interesting, back in the early histories, and it's not so true now, I don't hear it as much, but you know, they talked about our dogs as being educated opposed to being trained.
I think that's true. I think it is an education. We still talk about intelligent disobedience. The intelligent disobedience concept is another really important one. It's a big one. In all other cases of dog training, it's command, obey. Give a command, the dog obeys. In the case of a guide dog, it's give a command, and the dog has to think, obey if this is okay and safe, but intentionally disobey if this isn't safe. So if I walk up to the street corner and I say Vegas forward, and right in front of me is a ditch because they're digging up the water mains in town, he's not going to obey my command to go forward. In fact, he has to, by training, or he's obligated to, disobey, to apply intelligent disobedience and not obey a command that doesn't make sense. So I give a command, he has to say, obey if it makes sense, don't obey if this is my crazy human doing something he doesn't understand what he says, what he's saying. So that concept is a tough one. Again, it's fascinating to me to think about thinking in the dog's mind. Of course, we can't do this, and of course, I can't do this. But I have to wonder, what's the dog thinking? Because intelligent disobedience is only allowed to take effect in travel. I mean, I can't be, as you can tell, I think I have the best job in the world. I love what I'm doing. I've been a guide dog user since 1970 and very, very much I'm a believer. I think it's a great mode of travel. I was a good traveler before I got a dog, but I still just think it's a great way of travel.
I agree. So is there anything else that you really, really think people should know that we haven't covered?
I think people need to understand that working with a dog is a relationship. And I said working deliberately in that sentence. It's not using a dog. It's not like an appliance. It's not like a computer or a cell phone. It's a relationship to work with the dog. And in the same way, it takes time and energy and effort on the human's part to do anything with animals. If you're a horseback rider, if you're involved in other activities, you need to put your time in with the dog. I think that's just something very important for people to recognize. And for that, as one small reason and many other reasons, a guide dog isn't for everyone. If you're not willing to do that, if you're not willing to have a relationship with a dog, you know, many people don't have pet dogs for good and valid reasons. And so I just think as people consider possibly working with a dog, need to just remember that it takes energy and effort. You can't just say, well, this dog did something wrong. Sure, they are going to do things wrong. And working with the dog is, like I said, working is like being in a relationship with a child in your family or a spouse. and you have to put energy into it, and it's not always going to be perfect, but the rewards are really unimaginable.
Yes, sir. Now, people, of course, can get in touch with the Seeing Eye.
You bet. We are on the web at www.seeingeye.org. We are on the phone at 800-539-4425. We are on Facebook. We are on Twitter. What else is there? We are on ham radio with our club station W2TSE. So there are many ways that individuals could get in touch with the Seeing Eye.
Fantastic. And we really appreciate you taking some time for our listeners today, Jim.
Absolutely. Thank you.
As I said earlier, there's more to come from that trip to the Seeing Eye. Love to hear from you. Resources at sarahtalk.com is how you can get a hold of us by email. Leave an iReport on iBlink Radio using either your iOS or Android device. Go to www.sarahtalk.com and leave a comment on our blog. If you're visiting iTunes, be sure and leave a review of the podcast while you're there. Follow us on Twitter, www.twitter.com/sarahtalk. Or leave a comment on the Blab line, 866-997-2522. Have a great week, everybody.